Hello, heroes, and welcome, finally, to a new episode of Critical Success. I'm James D'Amato, your Game Master. It's certainly been a while since I've been able to put together an episode of Critical Success. One of the things I pride the One-Shot Podcast family on is professionalism, and Critical Success certainly has not displayed the level of professionalism that I am used to with my shows. The level of writing that goes into these episodes is a lot more intense than the sort of work that I have to put into to put together an episode of One Shot, which has made maintaining this series a little bit difficult. With the release of Campaign and One Shot staying in full swing, I want to make sure Critical Success is something that I can deliver consistently. So I've decided to broaden the scope a little bit. I think we all know there's a lot more to gaming than simply being a GM. There's of course the player side of things, but there's also the designer perspective to consider, and the community as a whole. From now on, Critical Success is definitely still going to feature the audio essays that started it all, but I'm also going to incorporate more roundtable discussions and interviews. I'll still have advice for GMs, but I'll also incorporate advice for players, game designers, and I'll just talk to you once in a while about the state of gaming. From now on, any sort of intellectual interest you could have in gaming beyond simply playing them is going to find a home at Critical Success. I'll be kicking off the brand new Critical Success with an interview. If you hang out on the RPG subreddit or the story game forum, which if you're listening to this show, you probably do one of those things, you'll recognize the name John Harper. And if you don't, you'll most certainly recognize his work. John is responsible for the much-beloved Lasers and Feelings, and the cult classic Lady Blackbird. If you like those games, or you like this conversation, you can head over to the 17 Design Studio to check out some of John's other work. John is a leader in story-based microsystems. When I was acting as a judge for the two-page tabletop competition, I noticed that a lot of entries were heavily influenced by John's work, and it's easy to see why. He's got a great sense for design economy, and some really sharp graphic designing skills. So many of his projects are experimental and provocative. And although Harper claims in this very interview that he's not one for innovation, for many designers, his work is a revelation. In a time where gamers are spoiled by brilliant, innovative new systems, his work is consistently described as must-play. And now that I've built it up, let's get to that interview. So everyone, let's meet our guest for this week, and that is John Harper of 17 Design Studio. Now, you might not recognize John's name, but you certainly recognize his work. John is responsible for beloved indie games like Lasers and Feelings and Lady Blackbird and Ghost Echo. Basically, if there is a microsystem that you have played in the last year, he probably designed it. John, welcome to Critical Success.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
So let's get sort of the boring background information out of the way first.
Sure.
How long have you been playing and how long have you been designing?
That's the same answer, roughly. Been playing about 30 years now or so. And I started out by playing Gamma World once with my friend, and then I promptly moved out of town. So I convinced him to photocopy the mutation tables on the Gamma World book, and went to my new town, got a group of friends together, and started running Gamma World by designing it as we went.
So oh, wow.
That's kind of how it started.
So you basically grabbed a fragment of a role-playing system and was like, well, this is good enough. I'll make up the rest as I go.
Yeah, pretty much.
Do you have a more flexible view of role-playing in general because of that experience? Like, every system that you pick up, do you just mod it as you go?
I think so. I definitely spent a lot of years playing sort of homebrew stuff, and hodgepodge systems, Frankenstein stuff, and then getting into champions and GURPS and that kind of stuff, mostly champions, using all those pieces to build things and really getting into this kind of, like, hot-rodding of games, but then fell in love with the Forge when it started up, and kind of got into that mode of thinking, which was much more academic, I guess, and trying to sort of meet the game where it lives and play it the way it's intended to be played. And that, of course, swung out into kind of a dogmatic approach of, no, we have to play it according to the rules. There's only one way to play it. But yeah, I think over the years, I've definitely tended to drift back towards modding in play, tweaking in play, really making the whole experience about successful play as opposed to preservation of a design.
Very interesting. That's something I definitely want to touch on a little bit later. But before we get too deep into it, what systems would you say that when you do play for fun, if you get a chance to play for fun these days, what are your go-to games and why do you admire their designs?
Wow. Yeah, that's a
loaded question. Yeah, we could spend the rest of the night talking about that.
And I would love to. I play a lot, actually. I have three groups, more or less, weekly groups. One of those is a playtest group for my current projects, generally. Mm-hmm. Another is often playtest for other people's projects. And then the third is kind of whatever. Yeah, what am I really admiring right now? There's a lot of cool stuff, new stuff that's happening. But the things I've been playing the most has been Stars Without Number, Kevin Crawford's great space adventure sandbox game, kind of love letter to Traveler. We played that for a couple years, probably 60-ish sessions of that.
Wow, okay.
Which is a pretty long campaign. We've had Apocalypse World series that have been longer than that, but generally speaking, we're more in the dozens of sessions, I think. But a lot of Stars Without Number. Love that game. It's wonderful. Yeah. Every part of its design is fantastic. And it touching on this thing we just talked about, it's very friendly to house ruling and modding. And in a way, it's almost set up to encourage that process. I think everyone who runs it immediately hits something where they think, I need to do this a different way, or I need to patch this perceived hole or whatever. And it's super easy to do that with that particular game.
That's interesting. That strikes me as a correlation that would have with Dungeon or Apocalypse World, the other system that you mentioned playing for a prolonged period of time. Is they're very easy to interface with as a designer and a player who just likes to change things.
Absolutely. And that was one of my favorite things about Apocalypse World when it first was in playtest, when Vincent was starting to write the sort of hacking the game chapter and made it very explicit, which is almost a first. I think that has happened a couple times before in gaming text, but his chapter definitely was a revelation in some ways, that not only do you expect people to hack your game, but you're going to kind of give them a guidebook on how to do it, or at least point them in a direction to start learning that process.
Yeah, it's something that the industry slowly tried to fight for ages, and Now that that's peeled away, I feel like some of the most successful independent games are really making their whole existence on that fact. If you look at Fate, that's exactly what Fate is doing these days, is coasting by on the fact that everybody has their own sort of agency when they construct a Fate game.
Yeah, absolutely. And that Fred and Rob and Vincent and myself and some of the other designers in that little niche, we all did kind of go through this graduate level game design course, Forge, over several years. Like it was a forum, but it was really a kind of intense study program, really. And it was almost like being in graduate school together. Like we shared our work with each other. We all influenced each other. We all stole stuff from each other. And I think that hacking, like we're all at summer camp building things together, that spirit permeated itself out into all the stuff that has come from that. And the wider indie games community, I think, is very open to the idea of, oh, I have a hack of Monster Hearts, and there's a hack of Dungeon World out right now on Kickstarter that's a hack of Dungeon World to play in the post-apocalyptic setting.
Yeah, yeah.
Hack of Apocalypse World.
Exactly.
Dungeon World. It's amazing.
I saw that. It was a little blown away by how full circle that game went.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that's always been true. Like, the Champions community was like that. The GURPS community was definitely like that. Star Wars D6, mm-hmm. when I was really into that in the 90s, there were a million hacks for that, which they eventually, you know, kind of made a generic system out of it. And it's always been part of the gaming community that I've been involved with, but...
No, I think you're right. Even thinking back to original Dungeons and Dragons, a lot of people were photocopying those books and passing them around, and they were war gamers who were used to messing with things. They knew how systems worked, and they could deconstruct them and rebuild them.
Yeah, and I think there was an expectation too that of running a game at your own table is partially an act of game design. I don't know when it happened. For me, it was probably early to mid 90s when this idea of kind of the game designer as a entity came into play, where people were like, oh, this was designed by so-and-so and they're so great. I'm not a designer. You know, all I do is I've just run this Techmel campaign for the last 10 years and have drawn 100 maps and have created all these rules, and I'm not a game designer. I'm just a GM, you know, and that thinking has always baffled me, like running any kind of game or even as a player.
Yeah.
It involves game design to some degree. And I think that's not a bug in role-playing. That's a feature for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Come to think of it, as a GM or even just as a play group, you have this sort of editorial say over what part of the game books that you're going to use. I can't tell you how many campaigns I've run where I've been like, no psionics. And that's me going, no, this particular rule set is not a part of what I think of when I think of Dungeons and Dragons, or whenever anybody says, oh, we're not going to use spaceship rules for this iteration of Star Wars because I don't want to deal with them, well, it's you're basically redesigning the game in your own way.
Definitely. And it's a real joy as part of role-playing. So many other types of games that I love, video games or poker or Pandemic or whatever, mm-hmm. They're a fun experience, but they're with friends, they're not generally creative experiences. They're collaborative, they're tactical, they're social, but they're not always creative per se. And obviously the act of role-playing is creative, but the process of turning all those dials and like you said, pulling out a whole module is an act of game creation. It's an act of game design. And as a player saying, you know, I don't want there to be time travel. I know we're playing this game that has time travel powers, but let's not do that. Then that's still game design. And it's one of the few types of games, I think, that allows the people playing the game to actively participate in its creation and continue that process, which is another thing, just to go off on a tangent here.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
The idea of kind of the rules as written or being somewhat dogmatic in the approach to play, and saying this is the rule, we're going to play it by the rules, none of us particularly like it, mm-hmm. but we're going to do it anyway. I think there's a lot of value to that. I think it's, you know, when you first go to your training class and you're learning to throw your left hook or whatever, it feels wrong, and you could easily be like, I don't want to do it this way, let's do it the way I like,
right,
and never learn how to throw the hook right. So I think being dogmatic and deciding, like, this time we all agree together, we are going to play by these rules and see what happens and see how what we think of them. And that's a valuable exercise.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But at the same time, knowing when to change and when to turn the dials and how to mod and how to have that conversation and who's the authority figure when it happens. It's not always the GM. And all those things are so elaborate and so... there's so much to it. It's exciting to me. It's an ongoing process with every group. I feel like the longer you play with a group of people, you get better and better at all the little game design skills that go into choosing what to play next and what parts of it are we going to have and what parts are we going to cut and how long are we going to play and mm-hmm. how fast are we going to gain XP and all those things, you know, each table, I think, gets better and better at.
Oh,
navigating those skills.
That's so fascinating, especially going to your point about authority and who has say over different parts of the game. Role-playing games in particular, and perhaps it's because of how arcane the language was at the beginning of role-playing games with the rules, where you weren't actually reading the rules and playing by the rules, you were interpreting the rules. And
yeah.
having its roots in wargaming like that, is there's this sort of shared authority between the players and the game itself, because the game is asserting authority in different points. You were saying earlier, like, oh, I might not like this rule, but we should probably play it that way. That happens all the time at the table, I'd say. It's actually ties into something that I want to get into in story gaming specifically, which your designs definitely have a huge roots with. I see a lot of correlation between the art of role-playing and role-playing design to improv and how it's mm-hmm. this sort of art by committee. Yeah. And since I threw that word out there, which is loaded in our community, I'll throw it to you. Do you see role-playing games as art?
Yes, with an asterisk.
Of course.
I think...
you don't need to commit that hard.
Yeah, right. I'm not just going to start a fight just for fun. No, I think it's similar to video games to me. This question has come up mm-hmm. Famously years ago when Roger Ebert said something stupid about video games not being art.
Yes, I remember that quote well.
Yeah, he wasn't always right about everything. He's a smart guy. But the answer, I think Tycho from Penny Arcade said something along these lines that I'm paraphrasing here, but he basically said the whole thing is made of art. You know, a video game is a million paintings, a million short stories, actor performances. It's every piece. If you break it open and look inside it, every piece is a piece of art.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put all those things together, how can you say it isn't art? It's made of art. And I feel that's half of my answer to the role playing thing. Like a role playing game document, PDF or book or whatever. It's illustrations. It's writing. It's mechanical design. It's all kinds of stuff that I would consider to be artistic endeavors or creative endeavors. I don't necessarily want to call the play of the game at the table a piece of art. I don't object to someone saying that, but I would never want to sit at a table and say, okay, everyone, it's time to play Apocalypse World. Let's make some art. that would never be my pitch or my intention. And it might be true that an audience member, and this is happening a lot more now mm-hmm. because of games being played on YouTube and stuff, an audience member, their experience of that game being played could be a performative artwork that the audience member is enjoying as art. I watch Adam Coble run Starts With That Number on YouTube, and I enjoy it for the performance of him and the players, and I enjoy it as a player of role-playing games and someone who loves Stars Without Number. There is a bit of performative art going on, but in my personal view is that that isn't the thing happening at the table. Isn't necessarily creating a work of art. I don't think.
That's interesting. My view is more that it's not necessarily in definitionally, when you play a game, it does not have to be an artistic experience. Certainly, you can be playing a game and just be doing it for fun and sit there rolling dice and adding up numbers, whatnot. But I think it can be approached in the way you can approach art. It's like when a kid is painting a picture, is their intention art? Probably not. But that doesn't mean when you're painting, you cannot engage in an artistic activity and endeavor. And I think there's a fine separation there. If we look at one of your games, The Mustang, for me, as being an improviser and an actor, I see a lot of the setup of that as a theater exercise. You very much put out, these are these characters, this is their motivation, I'm going to bring the story up to a certain point, and after that point, be those characters. And the act of observing that, being in that moment, I think that is art in its way, or it can be performed as art.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think to really get into this, we would have to have the conversation about what we mean when we say what art is, which we probably couldn't do.
Oh, it's that thing you know when you see.
I have 11 definitions of that word. But yeah, no, I would totally agree with that. And that's not an accident. That game was written for a contest that Jason Morningstar and Graham Walmsley, back then Graham Charles now, had on Story Games, a one-sheet, double-sided game design thing, which, of course, I had to do.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah, I forgot about that. That's really embarrassing. It doesn't matter. So that particular contest was after Ghost Echo came out, and they decided to have a contest to make Ghost Echo-type games. And they were anonymous entries, and I entered for fun, and they picked me as the winner. So that was extra awkward and weird that happened, and we ended up taking the, like, It was just an honorable mention thing. It was really awkward.
No, I love everything about that story. That
it's
is
crazy.
You so are just the best villain in a feel-good movie. You're like, you go undercover to win a contest about yourself.
What I was trying to get to is it's really Graham's fault because I wasn't going to do it, but I read his book Play on Safe, which is basically one of the Improv for Gamer books. Mm-hmm. It's the first one I read, and I'd only barely been involved with improv. I read what's his name, Keith Johnstone's book.
Is that okay. Impro. Okay, yeah, the British one.
I'd read that, and I'd done some workshops, but reading Graham's book just I was like, oh man, there's so much here, and there's so many great exercises and so many great sort of techniques to experiment with. He writes it all as kind of like, here's a thing you might try next time you play. Not like break out and do something totally different with your group, but the next time you play, see if you can lower your character's status in a scene. You know, play a subordinate to
right.
someone else, stuff like that. And that reading Graham's book really got into my brain. And during that contest, you're spot on. Like that was very much on my mind when I wrote that game. That kind of theater style setup and the way it plays out being kind of blocked and very scene driven.
Okay, well, we can state for the internet, the determination we made about this is completely neutral and the battle wages on. So everybody who feels up in arms about that subject can just go and feel good about the rest of this conversation. Let's get into some general design. And a trend that I noticed certainly in a lot of the forums that I look at and a lot of the people who approach me to look at their games is I see a lot of genre and setting neutral systems being thrown out there, just the bare mechanics. And looking a lot of like where you started is actually very interestingly different from where I see you as a designer, because a lot of your games hand people a setting, hand people a story and say go, whereas your origin as a player is taking a system and just, you know, using that as a rough guideline for play. So where do you see the importance of a setting and that sort of thing for game design?
I feel like it's kind of like what Vincent said one time about, or maybe it was Emily. It was probably Emily, boss, talking about the GM role and how you can have a game without a GM, you can have a game with a GM, you can have a game with a lot of GMs. Regardless of how you slice it up, there are certain things that the GM does that the game needs in order to work.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to put them somewhere. You don't have to have a GM, but those jobs still need to get done, so you've got to stick them in your game somewhere.
Right.
Which I think is a really great insight, and the notion that might not be true is also very interesting. That immediately makes me think, like, well, maybe that isn't true. Maybe you can get rid of those jobs. And, that branch of design is interesting, too. And Emily has done a lot of cool stuff in that space, too. But that, I feel like that's similar with setting. Like, if you make if you're Steve Jackson and you make GURPS,
right.
you can't play GURPS without a setting. So someone has to provide it. Either it's buying a setting book from GURPS or making up the game yourself, doing that part of the design work yourself at the table. Someone has to do it. So I think it's totally great and cool to make a settingless generic game system, but it's kind of like making a setting that doesn't have a mechanic. Like, it's someone has to provide the other part of the thing that it doesn't have.
I think that's a great perspective on it, is that you're essentially what you're doing when you drop that part of it is you're asking somebody to come along and engage with that material and bring their own piece, which can be good or bad, because you can, you know, end up with a fate or end up with GURPS where there are a lot of people who want to engage with that and change it, but that, like, otherwise you're just sort of not offering everybody everything that you could be offering them, and that's a risk that you take in your design process.
Yeah, and I think for the most part, all of those kind of generic systems do market themselves with other, you know, with settings and with quick play stuff. And I don't think I've ever seen anything that was just a set of mechanics, but yeah.
I have seen a lot.
I've seen people post up on story games like that and want feedback, and it's very hard to give for me.
That's actually what I wanted to segue into, is that I see these systems as a different kind of heartbreaker, in that it's hard to engage with the material because you're just looking at potential math. Like, there's no feedback that you can give a system like that except, well, the probability works like this.
Yeah, because the picture is bigger than that and is challenging. To create a game totally from scratch, you have to answer a lot of questions or conveniently ignore them and hope no one notices, which is what you usually do. With those type of mechanics, like you said, you can say, yes, these numbers work. Yes, you're getting 80% success rate for your experts, which is what you said you wanted. But does that serve the needs of the game? And we don't know, because we don't know what the game is about. In some ways, I think everyone has different processes, and for certain types of designers, I can see that being a very powerful way to begin, where you know you have this foundation, and then you can kind of grope forward and find the wrapper that fits the thing you have, or do it the other way and start with some compelling piece of fiction and insert mechanics into it to make it function, or do it both ways or whatever. So I can see the appeal, but yeah, I've never been able to really engage very strongly there without a real setting. And even when we were doing Champions, and it was Champions, we did transition over to Hero System and play Cyber Hero and Fantasy Hero and their other settings and stuff. And we were all crazy Hero System modders and stuff, but it started out very much with Champions, and it was all about serving the superhero comic book genre,
right,
that we had chosen to do. So we could go on for hours about exactly how to model someone's killing attack and what kind of if we had a focus or if it was independent and blah 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 blah. But the reason we could do that is we all had this like wrapper that we knew it was in service to four color superheroic fiction, and once we had that wrapper, then we could go talk about the mechanics all day long. But yeah, I find it challenging to talk about the mechanics in the vacuum.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's actually, you touched on another thing that I find very interesting about the design process. I've been designing a game of my own recently, and what I found, a lot of it is a genre deconstruction. I had source material, and I looked at it, and I was like, how do I make these moments in the source material easy for somebody to do by accident while messing around with my mechanics? Do you find genre play like affects your work a lot?
Absolutely. I think Apocalypse World definitely helps, or the way that it's structured helps me with that process. Even if I'm not doing an Apocalypse World powered game, which is hard to say anymore. Everything I do is basically somehow, even when I think I'm going off in left field, I 6 months into it, I go, oh, yeah, this is just really, it's impossible.
We're all standing on the shoulders of giants. It's okay.
Oh, yeah. That's all of my games are like that. The Lady Blackbird is the Shadow of Yesterday, and I have no problem not being an innovator. Innovation is too hard. I'm way too lazy for that. I would much rather follow the geniuses and build on their work. but with the genre thing in particular, I think it was Sean Nittner, maybe, who's working on his Battlestar Galactica Apocalypse World con game scenario thing, hack game, mini game, whatever it is. And he posted a great series of things on his blog, as I recall, about watching Battlestar Galactica through again and going, through the scenes with an eye for moves and going like, yes, okay, this keeps happening. This thing where President, what's her name, Rosalind, is doing this thing with her council members, like, that's a move. Right? Now I see it. And there's the thing where the cast has to like brief the troops, and sometimes the morale is up and sometimes it's down, and that should be a move. And that process of rewatching something that you love so much for its fictional artistry, sort of with this ruthless eye towards tearing it apart and seeing the guts inside it, but not as like an art critic necessarily, but as a game maker.
Yeah, well, me, somebody so who would take apart a clock to see how it works. It's essentially the same mindset.
Yeah, it's like you said, like someone has to accidentally reproduce it in a way, and the level to which it's accidental, I think, has a lot to do with how the game presents itself from a marketing and branding perspective, and also presents itself in a kickstarting, setting you up for success kind of way. Which is something that a lot of games completely ignore. Almost all role-playing games totally ignore. some of the best ones, especially one of my favorites, Basic Dungeons & Dragons, Tom Mulvey's 1986 or 84 edition, whichever one it is. He doesn't care about town. He doesn't care about how the characters know each other. He doesn't care about any of that stuff. You make your characters, and the text says, the adventure begins outside the door to the dungeon, and you play. Automatic success, because going into a dungeon is fun, doing dungeon stuff is fun, and so many people took that game and said, you're in a tavern, do you want to order a drink? And immediately their D&D game turned to crap and just fell apart, because everyone went, yeah, I yell at the barkeep to support, well, I go over to, and it, all of a sudden you're like, what is happening? I thought we were playing Dungeons and Dragons. This is crazy. And we got off the rails immediately into something. Who knows what's going to happen? I was talking to Paul Riddle about this the other day. He has a game coming out called Undying, which is his sort of diceless, semi-apocalypse world-inspired love letter to World of Darkness Vampire. Beautiful game. Really, really cool game. And the design of the game has been done for a year or so. The writing is almost done. And Paul's like, no, I'm not done yet. Like, I need to write the thing that sets you up for success. That when you sit down to play the first time, how does the game start? What's the first thing that happens? Why are the characters doing that thing? And it's not a specific, you know, one thing. This is the only way it can start, like Lady Blackbird or something. But I want to take all these rules and stuff and not just trust the GM to have this deft hand and then just kind of magically know how exactly to start the game out. Instead, I'm going to set them up for success. So the very first experience of playing this game is going to be a positive and fun one, and is going to advance the characters to a place where they're going to do the thing the game is about, and it's going to be easy for the GM to pull it off.
Oh, man, absolutely. And that's such a mark of somebody who has been through the design process before. My first few iterations of my game, I was just like, oh, everybody will run the game the way I do because it's a game that I would be interested in. And my design partner was like, well, no, we need to design some way for them to get that that's how the game is supposed to be run.
And that's another act of game design, right? Like, so many people who say, oh, I'm just a GM. Yeah, but you came up with this awesome thing where everyone was in these cryopods and they woke up and they didn't have their personalities loaded. And they had to go to the machine to pick which personality to load into their brain implants. And that's not in Traveler. Like, you just made that up and it's super cool. And it like created this amazing campaign. It's so important that you did that. That's what the game you ended up playing is, that cool setup you wrote.
Absolutely. And that game master is creating opportunities for their players to do interesting and cool things, which is really what the rules are creating opportunities for everybody. So in a sense, you're absolutely right. Again, that game master, and really everybody involved in that process is doing some element of design, whether or not it's inspired by the rules. Like, as we pointed out in this conversation, we're inspired by all sorts of rules, even when we make completely new systems.
Yeah. Yeah. Those things are so important, I think. The way it starts, who the characters are and what they want, the methods they might undertake to get those things, what happens when they get them, what happens when they fail to get them, and then how does it sort of wrap up or resolve into the next situation or the game ends. Those things are not mechanics. Usually some games do have, like, Primetime Adventures kind of has mechanics around that stuff. But those things are so important to the experience, to what happens at the table and what people remember and how much they enjoy it, that I always tell new designers, like, when you first start playing, if you have a cool idea for a mechanic, write it down, use it, play it, you know, obviously go nuts with your stuff. Like, don't hold back, put the stuff in play. If you feel stuck and you're like, oh, I don't know how to do this, I don't know how to make this mechanic, I don't know what, if there should be, you know, a chase system in here, if we're going to have, like, cool drivers or something in this game, I don't know how to write it, or feel like that you have to write all that stuff just in case it comes up.
Right.
I always tell them, like, just placehold everything, put coin flips in for anything that you don't have. If something comes up, just flip a coin, you know, heads is good, tails is bad, and play the game, and you'll be able to tell really fast, like, if you have this compelling, engaging, cool setup and characters and desires and actions and payoffs, if that stuff is firing, then when someone needs to do a chase and they just flip a coin for it, they're probably going to be like, eh, that wasn't as cool as it could have been.
Right.
But this game is awesome. Like, I'm having so much fun. My character is super cool. And I love that we're trying to stop the psychics that are invading from Venus or whatever. Like, that's going to be really on fire. And if you do it the other way around, I feel like it's often very easy to forget about those things and say, oh man, I finally got the underwater combat system all worked out. Like, okay, cool, but you still got to have a cool opening. You still got to have characters people want to play.
Right,
you still
got
to
right.
have stuff to do and places to go and things to, you know.
That's such a great playtesting advice note for people, because I know there are a lot of people who fumble around with playtesting and, you know, feel like, oh, I'm putting so much of what is important to me out there, and like there's a risk of it falling apart and being totally devastating. Yeah. But if you reach one of those moments and you just go, well, this isn't where we're playtesting, this isn't important, we'll resolve it with a coin flip and come back to it, that keeps your game moving, it keeps your playtest afloat, and it keeps you focused on the rules that you've put down and that are important to you.
Absolutely. And it's that itself is a playtesting note. If you have a coin flip for something, you've spent 0 seconds of your time designing that mechanic. And if that turns out to work...
Good for you, yeah!
You've saved yourself so much effort by just going to the easiest thing first. And what often, that usually doesn't happen, and there aren't a lot of games that still have coin flips randomly stuck into them, but what does often happen is that it just never comes up. That mechanic that you thought was going to be so important and you were really stressed about it, and it's not done yet, so I can't playtest yet because I don't have the economy for the guilds in place yet. You can still go ahead and play. It's fine. And you are all worried about it, and oh my god, when that comes up, we're just going to flip a coin to see if they make their payments or not. It's going to be lame. And then it never happens. And there's probably going to be 8 or 10 of those in your design that, before you start playing, it's very hard to know what's going to actually be important and where the game is actually going to need a mechanic and where it isn't. And the more you design, the better you get at guessing those things, but it's not 100% thing. And it just kills me to see people that have spent in their little designer oubliette just like, laboring away at 1,000 pages of stuff to make sure they've covered all their bases before they've ever played the game.
Right.
And man, it's not like it's a tragedy necessarily. Like if they enjoyed that process and they made something they love, that's great. But for me, my design process is just the laziest approach possible. Like I have an idea for a game experience that I can't currently get from something else, and my goal is to have that experience, not to design that game. So the faster and easier I can have the experience, the better. And if that ends up being, oh wait, we can just play Monster Hearts, but we'll be adults and we'll change this and that, great, okay, I don't need to design a game, woo, awesome, let's do that. Everyone's different, but for me as a designer, I just can't get into this mode. Like, I am going to be the guy who makes this.
Right.
This is my mission. I'd rather be the guy who manages to make that game happen at the table, and we all have a good time. And since we play a lot, our sort of local community is focused on play as the primary thing, not so much reading games or designing games or... talking on the internet necessarily as our primary interactions. It's very play focused. Since you're playing all the time, some of those things are going to fall by the wayside, and they're going to get be done, and everyone had a good time. And some of them are going to catch fire, and everyone's going to go, "Oh man, this is there's something to this. This needs to be a thing." And you know, it's almost like the difference between being a lone artist by yourself, mm-hmm. doing your paintings in your attic, versus being in a community of artists, all working together every day, looking at each other's work, talking about it. You know, it just changes the dynamic completely.
Wow, and I see that so much in your designs too, especially like what you said with creating or chasing an experience that you're not finding in something else, is your designs provide specific information that could distract, that could otherwise distract somebody from getting the experience of the game. One of the things that I love, and a lot of people very evidently based on the designs that I saw in the 2-page tabletop competition love, is your scenario table, because there's a lot of, like, these were games that were designed for people to pick up and start playing right away. And yes. That scenario table takes the, well, as a GM, I still have to create the story, completely off the table, because that's not the point of the system. The point of the system...
In Lasers and Feelings.
Yeah, well, is being caught between those two things, is being caught between action and emotional interaction.
Yeah, totally. And that's something, I think it was, hesitate to be concrete about this, but I think it was Poisoned... Probably that was my first real experience with that kind of thing. At Gen Con that year when Vincent released it, we sat down and played it, with Vincent, and he didn't run it. Did he run it? He might have run it. I forget. But the rest of us hadn't played it or read it, and it just hit me like a truck. It was just like, oh. The first thing you read in this booklet is the first thing that happens on screen in the game. And we haven't even made characters yet, but we can't wait to make characters now.
Right.
Because you just told us that all these things are going on the deck, and the cook that killed the captain is there laughing in our faces, and the British naval ship is pulling up anchor and coming to kill us. And while you were all telling us that, we're going, oh, no. I get out of my way. I got to make my guy. I have stuff to do. I need to do X, Y, and Z right now.
God, and that's why I see setting as so important to game design, is because that inspires that passion. The reason that role-playing games exist as they are role-playing games is because we imposed stories on bare rules. They evolved accidentally. And that story is what's driving you forward to want to know about all those rules. I definitely, in my power gaming days, I was a power gamer because I wanted my character to live.
Yeah, totally. I didn't go through that phase because I was a GM all through that period of my life.
I guess, yeah, you would.
when being a power gamer would have been, like, the best thing. I got to be a GM, which is, like, the ultimate power trip, right?
Right.
But I think because of that, I got into this mode where my friend who just got into gaming a few years ago and started out as a GM kind of has a similar vibe where we feel like we're just ready to play the next guy. We're so used to playing a lot of characters, a lot of NPCs, mm-hmm. that playing a PC for more than two or three sessions is kind of like, okay, that was cool. Like, I'm ready to move on. If this guy dies or whatever, that's fine. If he doesn't, maybe I'll have him retire and I'll make someone else. And we're always in this mode of, like, wanting to kind of burn our characters out really fast. And everyone's going, "Don't do it, you idiot! You have a -3 to your roll." We're like, whatever. It's cool. We got a bunch of other guys I want to play. Don't worry about it.
Oh, that's interesting. I've always actually wondered how that mentality cropped up. I, as somebody who started as a player, definitely feel a very fierce attachment to a lot of the characters that I play. And it always sort of baffled me that there were people who were insisting upon death in games and insisting like that is the point of this game, is that you're going to die and that's going to be fun. And it blew my mind. But I guess if you're starting from that perspective of the game master, and these days I absolutely love diving into dozens of NPCs per session. But if you're starting from that perspective, that makes total sense. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, I think that's one way, and the other is another type of control. I think if you are playing something where you're playing something that's super deadly and you're supposed to care about your characters a lot, and they're kind of hard to make, and you invest a lot of time in them. I think that's a bad combo. I think games that are run that way are often not intended to be done that way, but that's a little bit of a tangent. We can talk about that if you want, but character stables and things. But I do think that is another reaction. One reaction is the very reasonable, like, I'm going to work as hard as I can to keep my guy alive because I really care about him. And that's a way to control the situation. And I think another way is to give up and be like, okay, fine. If that's what you want, then I'll just take all the risks. I'll die. I'll make a new guy. I'll make a new guy. That's how I'm going to protect myself emotionally from this character.
Right.
You know, I'm just going to let him go and whatever. I'll make a new guy and erase the first name and write a new one. And when he dies and reroll his stats, fine, whatever. It's his brother. They're twins. Fine. Let's go on. I've seen that happen too.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that has happened in a lot of Call of Cthulhu that I've played, which is, I guess, that is a system that is designed for that, to chase that very much.
Yeah. That's another, I had a weird experience. My civics teacher in junior high owned and ran the local role-playing game store and was a GM for a lot of our campaigns and stuff. And he ran Call of Cthulhu, and he was just a murderous, vile, evil GM. But he was really good at setups. He was really good at setting expectations. So when you sat down to play, he knew none of us had really read Lovecraft or anything. We were pretty, I think I'd read Call of Cthulhu or something at that point, but he just said, look, this is a story about a group of people who get into a situation they can't deal with, and most of them die or go insane. That's what we're going to do now. And
right.
We all were like, oh, okay, let's do that. We're going to play a horror movie, essentially, where most of us don't make it out. Probably none of us make it out. And it's going to be creepy and weird, and that's the point of it. And there, we didn't have that friction between the, like, we're playing D&D, the single character, precious character D&D, and we're calling it Call of Cthulhu, and those two things are really at odds with each other, like, my investigator has an attack bonus with his Tommy gun, and I'm going to be awesome, and I'm going to gun down cultists, and I'm an adventurer, I'm a hero, but we're playing Call of Cthulhu. Oh, no, like, I can't. I'm going to die. All the talk of Call of Cthulhu I've seen online kind of revolves around that friction. Like, why were things so hard, and our characters were dying all the time, and we went crazy, and I'm always like, yeah,
That's what that game is designed to do to you.
I mean, when I played it, the guy who ran it for me told me that I was going to die or go insane, and then it happened. I think that touches back on that idea of how do you start the game, how do you set expectations, what do people expect the game to be, what kind of characters are they excited to create. It all goes back to that initial kernel of what the game is, what we're here to do. As a group.
All right. Well, with that, I actually kind of wanted to segue into talking very specifically about some of your games. Particularly, I wanted to talk about Lasers and Feelings because, as I mentioned before, in the two-page tabletop contest, that game has influenced so many young designers. And it seemed to me like a very simple project, but first thing I want to know is how long did you take to make that?
It took about, I'm going to say 3 hours, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe 4, something like that. It was a similar thing to Lady Blackbird. Mm-hmm. There was a thing that was happening that night, and the idea came to me at 3 in the afternoon. And I was like, oh, this would be great for tonight. I should make this. And so the immediate deadline meant, oh, it can only be like really, really short. And the original Lady Blackbird was also very, very short.
I was going to say, Lady Blackbird is a lot more work intensive. I'd be impressed if you made that in a couple hours.
The first version was, it was all the characters and the owl.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was in the original one. And then Sage was like, these rules are only half a page. You should just put them on the other half of the character sheet. they got longer, but still. So with Lasers and Feelings, there was the Double Clicks were releasing the album, maybe, or they were doing a concert. I forget exactly what was happening that night. And I actually know them because of Lady Blackbird. They live in Portland, and my friend Brendan Atkins, who lives there, knows them, and he ran Lady Blackbird for them one time, and they tweeted at me like, "We love Lady Blackbird," and then I looked at their band and I was like, "I love you guys." So that was cool. But I had kind of wanted to do something in the DoubleClix universe. They have a lot of great songs about dinosaurs and stuff, and
right,
I thought, yeah, it'd be cool to do something in this mode. So yeah, it came together really fast. I didn't have anything to do that afternoon, so I threw it together and then got really stuck on the mission table.
Really? Okay.
Everything was done, and I had this big blank spot, which is why there's an illustration of the ship there, because I was like, man, this doesn't even fill page. Like, I got to put something here. But I had blocked out the mission table, and I had, like, two things on it and was really stuck. And my friend Ryan, who's a game designer and plays in our local group, he was in the office that day, so I brought him over. I was like, take a look at this.
Mm-hmm.
And he looks at it for like 1 second, and he's like, "Well, obviously," he's like, "ding, ding, ding," and he rattles off a bunch of awesome things.
Yeah, that struck me as a writer's room project where totally. You just like, this is the basic format I have for a thing, and you just sit around as a bunch of people go, "Yeah, hi, Varmada. That's a good one."
So he got it about halfway there, and then I got it all done except for one cell, and I had a total blank again. And I called him back over, and he wrote the best thing on that table, which is, it's in the last thing. It's like, so-and-so is going to do this to this thing.
Does it fix everything?
Fix everything.
Yep.
Ryan wrote that. It's the best. I think it's the best thing that's ever been on a role-playing table. Like, it's so good.
It's perfect.
So good.
I ran that for our actual play show. I ran Lasers and Feelings, and that popped up on the table, which it was the most delightful experience I had had in any sort of role-playing game, because no matter what was going to happen, it was all guiding to something that was going to tie everything up. Doesn't matter how, I know everything's going to be set in order by this event. It was, yeah.
I think it was when you posted about that. I remember sending Ryan a link like, "Hey, somebody rolled it. Look." I feel like it might have been your game, but yeah. So good. Yeah, but the hacking, it's not surprising. Like, that game is so super easy to hack. And it itself is somewhat a hack of Ron Everett's game, Troll Babe, a little bit. The die mechanic is,
mm-hmm.
It's different. It's my own kind of like multi-dice kind of interpretation of Troll Babe, but...
Yeah, and I have found it like, it's not that mechanic that's like that hard to come up with. All Out of Bubblegum has a similar roll under, roll over mechanic, which is, if you're trying to limit the amount of supplies that people have to engage with, that is a beautiful way to do it. You've tied two stats to a single roll.
Yeah, and it goes back to, I think it was on Story Games maybe, or a blog post about, I love Apocalypse World, I want the three results in my games now.
Right.
I don't want pass fail anymore. I want miss, partial, full success. How can I hack? I think it was D&D at the time, but the thread turned into lots of different stuff. And that was one of the solutions that I proposed at the time, was to, if you have any game that uses a die and rolls against a target number, you can play Apocalypse World style. You just add a die, and if both dice succeed, then it's a full success. If one does, it's a 7-9. If they both fail, it's a miss. And you can just port that into whatever you want to play. And 316, Gregor Hutton's amazing masterpiece game, has a pass-fail mechanic. And now when I play it, I always do it with two dice and just have that nice three. I'm a Talos Lanta nut, so the partial, full, miss, critical scale is like very comforting to me. I like it when games have that.
Well, actually, yeah, it's so funny that you mentioned that, because your table and the partial success mechanic are what made it. When you looked at what did designers think was important in games and what did they want in their own system, they're like, I want a way for people to get started playing right away, and I want a way for people to have interesting failure. Interesting failure are the two words that, if I did a word search of every game in that competition, I'd say 90% of them had interesting and failure right next to each other.
Yeah, that's great. That's such an important thing. I forget where I encountered that. Burning Wheel is definitely what I always think of when someone says that.
Mm-hmm.
As an ethos, as a game design principle, that game is probably the best at interesting failure as a driving core concept. That, man, if everyone who did that contest who's really into interesting failures should give themselves the gift of playing like a 12-ish session Burning Wheel series, because, man, that'll just get it into your bones. It's really the best.
Very, very cool. That's great homework for folks.
Yeah, I know, right? It's what a chore. I have to play Burning Wheel.
I'll expect everybody to have their actual plays on my desk by next week, listeners.
Right. You know, speaking of that, to go on another brief tangent.
Go ahead.
We were talking before about good openers, like strong wrappers, setting expectations in the context of mini games that are mostly one shots or like brief series. And most of my games kind of are in that mode, right? They're like, mm-hmm, very simple and very, very short in presentation and in play. And I think Burning Wheel is a really good example of a game that has a wealth of amazing, tight, cool starting scenarios. I think the new version of Gold has 3 or 4 or 5 maybe in the book that are all wonderful. And the Adventure Burner teaches you how to make them, essentially, which is another amazing product. I'll chill for Luke Crane here. Adventure Burner is amazing. But the thing I wanted to touch on, I was talking to Luke about this once. He was saying, oh man, like, you get so much mileage out of such a tiny amount of text. Like, you get away with it. Like, how can you write a 1-page game? How can you write a 12-page game? I got to slave over this giant 300-page thing, and it kills me. And you just get to like dash out some little thing and blah, blah, blah. And I said, Luke, yeah, but the play is different. Like, playing Lasers and Feelings is like watching an episode of Star Trek. And playing Burning Wheel is like reading all of the Edda or the Iliad or something. Like,
right.
They're different experiences. They're not just interchangeable gaming. You know, one is this huge experience. One is like watching The Wire. And one is just, you know, playing a Galaga or whatever.
Right, right. That's such an interesting point, because when we were promoting the 2-page tabletop contest, a lot of people were like, well, you're just going to get a bunch of entries that are 8-point font and completely unreadable. And it's like, well, you can, and we certainly did get a bunch of those entries. They're trying to cram as much onto one page as possible, but there's also the simplicity of going, well, there are certain experiences that I can highlight and leave everything else to be in the moment. And the people who really took to that are the people who were chasing, as you said before in your design process, chasing specific experiences.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I think that's totally true. And it's wonderful that we're in a position now. I mean, I guess it's always been true, but man, gaming, I feel so lucky to be a gamer. I felt this in 2005. I was like, this is amazing. Like, The Shadow of Yesterday and Sorcerer and Dogs in the Vineyard and Primetime Adventures and The Pool. And, like, this is the best gaming's ever been. And now it's 1,000 times better.
It's
so many exciting games and designers and communities and discussions. Man, it's just wonderful.
I'm totally blown away, because it feels like I am a person who likes all sorts of different gaming experiences. And I feel like every single game experience that I care about, whether it's strictly mechanical, whether it's about world building or, you know, interpersonal interaction, all these things, there is a game that has come out within the last 2 years that does that better than I ever thought it was possible for something to do those things.
Yeah.
Oh, it's absolutely, it's great. I want to turn the conversation towards micro games, which is something that you are really the king of, Because, as I said, all these people who were designing micro games looked to your games for cues for their own designs. Do you think it is possible for there to be a market for something like that beyond what I see as the Patreon market? And that's, you know, somebody who likes what you're doing and wants you to do more things.
Yeah.
Do you see micro games actually getting an edge in the market? Because I know there are people that play them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think they get played a lot. I know they do, just based on APs and emails and stuff that I get. Mostly because of these things we've been talking about that are easy to get off the ground. They're very low, low prep, quick to start. Easy to read, you know. It takes 15 minutes to read and absorb the whole thing at the most. And I think that has partially to do with the aging gamer population. And that's kind of the way I think of it. Like, I don't have time anymore to spend 18 hours a week as a GM prepping a game.
Right.
I don't know anyone who does. So games that don't require that are more attractive. And there's a lot to that that it's hard to figure out exactly what the factors are. But yeah, when it comes to a business model, that to me is all, it's a different job. It's like almost orthogonal, not completely, but it's another vector in the equation. The game right. you design and the game you market and sell, those are the same game, but those are two different roles you play. And as an indie person, like, you typically do both of them, but yeah, I don't think there's any reason why I think an interesting example is something like Murderous Ghosts, Vincent's game, or The Sundered Land, his like tiny little 7 mini game apocalypse powered fantasy thing, which is brilliant and gets played a lot but doesn't get talked about online very much because people have fun when they play it and they don't have a lot of problems, so they kind of don't talk about it.
Right.
But those are interesting as products. Murderous Ghost is this really cool product that comes in a DVD case and has a disc in there with the PDF on it and like 11 other games and these cool little booklets and the player booklet and the GM booklet, and they look beautiful, and it's just this great product. And then Sundered Land is this little PDF with hardly any art, and it seems kind of like, oh, Vincent just threw this together. But, you know, they were both these, like, big labors of love to make. One, he wanted to invest time and energy marketing as a product, and the other, he didn't.
Right.
But I think you could flip that around and say, oh, yeah, Murderous Ghost is just a PDF on my website. Go get it. And Sundered Land is this beautiful set of booklets that I've made that are cloth-bound things with a custom ribbon bookmark and a slipcase and with this wonderful product to sell as a product.
That's interesting, yeah. Like, in how you have to take these games and essentially dress them up as a product that people are familiar with buying. When I look at a game like Dread, which is, you know, one of my favorite games designed, it's a game that really, when you get down to it, it could fit on a single page. But they had to turn it into a book that was 700 pages in order to sell it as a product, because it is well designed enough that it deserves to be sold and they deserve to be compensated for that work. But
yeah, although I do think that I don't know, I'm not much of a futurist type person, but I do think that is changing, that the expectations around what counts as a game. There is a vocal minority on the internet, especially, that will bitch and moan a lot about page counts and how much of the book was wasted on art, they like to say. but I feel like that generation, I mean, they were vocal and really, really felt important 20 years ago, but now, I don't know. I think we're seeing a shift, and it's a shift within the tiny niche of the little community that we're a part of. Like, I'm not saying across, if like Vincent took and Epi, I think, was there too. They took Dread and Murderous Ghosts and Brett Dillon's game, The Final Girl horror game, and a couple others, I think. And they went to a horror convention. and they had a booth set up at a horror convention where everyone's there to like buy bootleg DVDs and watch horror movies and all that stuff. Not a gaming convention at all. And they did not sell anything. It was a big disaster. And Vincent wrote about it on his blog a lot. And it did. It came down to this weird, it was strange to them. Like, in our world, a game needs to be a book. It needs to be a proper book that's several hundred pages, and it looks cool, and you put it on your bookshelf, and it's a book. And that was the opposite experience they had with these customers. They would pitch them on the game, hey, do you love Evil Dead? Do you want to do Evil Dead at home with your friends? Yeah, I totally do. And they go, cool, here it is. And they would show them this book, and they would look at it and go, what? How is this a game? This is a book.
Oh, wow.
Games aren't books. This doesn't make any sense. A game is like, it's at least a box, but it's like on your phone. you know what I mean? Like, the expectations are so different. So I'm hopeful that people who care enough to take on the job, because it's a big job to create new markets and figure out new ways to package products. That's not trivial. That's, I mean, my non-gaming career is that. Like, I work in marketing and advertising.
Okay.
It's a whole massive industry, right? It's not a trivial thing to say, but I am hopeful that we're not, that the days of role-playing game equals book are, they're not dead yet, but I feel like it's on the way out.
Oh, that is a really interesting proposition, especially considering a lot of people who are playing role-playing games for the first time are playing a micro system that they don't have to engage with the same way you would have to engage with a system that is a book.
Yeah, or at least I will backpedal slightly because I do think a role-playing game presented as a book is a wonderful combination of art forms, like the way role-playing games are structured and written and the way books present information is a very, you know, there's a good reason why those things go together.
Right, right.
Finally, we can throw off the shackles of books. I'm a book designer. I love making books. Books are great. But I think we might be moving away from the necessity to say, like, if you have a game, it must be a book.
That
there's a variety of possible forms it might take. There's a really cool, man, I wish I could remember it. I'm blanking right now. I'll try to find it. Maybe we can put it in the show notes. But someone from the story games community created a kind of choose your own adventure cyberpunk website, which is just amazing. It's such a cool and fun story. It's not really like choose your own adventure. It's its own weird offshoot of that. It's hilarious. It's minimally designed. It's beautiful. It's all kind of pinkish purple text on a black background, and it involves cupcakes in some way, I forget, but it's really, really wonderful. And someone, I think James Stewart, shared it on the Story Games Weekly email thing, and rightly so. Like, at first blush, it's like, oh, this is just kind of a like little web game that you click through web game. Why is this on Story Games? But it totally is a story game. It's completely in the mold of what you would think of as an indie gamer, story gamer type of thing. But it's presented in this little, you know, HTML format. Or Jackson Tegu's game Silver and White, which is a text, but it's you read it while you play the game. You don't read it ahead of time. You open it and start reading it, and that's when the game starts.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah, and Meg Baker's game, 1001 Nights, can be played that way, too. So, yeah, that's also kind of subverting the notion of what is, like, it's a book, but it's also a tool for play. It's a thing you pass around and read aloud from. It's, you know, I don't know. It's not an easy question. The turning minigames into products is a challenging proposition. I think, as someone who's just starting out and no one is familiar with your work, just like anything else, your only option really is to fake it until you make it and give it away until someone wants to give you money for it.
Right.
That's what everyone does. No one wants to hear that, but that's what you do. In any creative field, I think you have to just put your work out there, share it, join a community, talk to people, be open, and eventually someone will hold you down and say, shut up, take my money. You're awesome. I need to pay you for this. That's not the only way to do it, And there's a lot of different nuances to that that I'm skimming over, but.
Yeah, there's, I part of me hopes, especially having been in the improv community in Chicago for so long, there's got to be eventually a more humane way to go about that, because there's a huge amount of time commitment that goes into any creative endeavor that really can drag you down. But let's jump into that nitty gritty, because this is a thing that is hugely present in a lot of young game designer or really any aspect of the gaming field's mind.
Sure.
Which is, how much time would you say you spend quote unquote promoting your work?
I would say that, it's, I have two answers. I guess it's just one answer, actually. I try to be available online. Most of my work involves me sitting on a computer.
Right.
So it's okay for me to just have G Plus open and Story Games open and GChat going and stuff and just kind of be available online in general. I don't participate in forums as much as I used to. I think that's super important. Or G Plus or Facebook or whatever your preferred outlet is. I think that is really important. The reason I said I had two answers was, like, the time I, like, legit spend promoting myself, it was pretty small. Sending out updates about Patreon, tweeting about a game I'm working on, I would say that's kind of directed promotion. That's very, very tiny. I might do that once a week at the most or something. But the other half of that is, or the other 99% of that is, I am my brand. As an indie game designer, I am 17 Design. The way Luke is Burning Wheel, and the way Vincent is Lumpa Games, and Vincent and Meg. And so in a sense, like, everything I do is promotion in some way. So I try to be mindful of that, and I try to really treat it like, I don't treat it like a job, like, oh, I gotta go participate online now, what a drag. But I do take it very seriously, and I think, especially starting around, I don't know when it was, I think it was 97-ish maybe, my friend Jonathan and I put our first game online, our first free PDF game, because I read, I think Jared Sorensen's Pumpkin Town or something maybe, I forget exactly, but maybe it was an earlier game of his, and they're like, wait, you can just make something and put it on a website for free and then people will play it?
Right.
This is amazing. So starting back then, we just fell into this idea that this is what it was. Like, we're not, and we have the luxury of having other jobs. Like, I would never tell someone, become an indie game designer to pay your rent.
Right.
Although, I personally am trying to do that. I'm moving into that space, but
aren't we all?
Right. Starting out, you know, it's crazy. It's like saying, I'm going to move to Hollywood and become a big time actor. Like, okay, great. Good luck. You should probably get a waitress job, I think. but yeah, like, moving into that online space, talking to other designers, promoting other people's work, tweeting and Facebooking and Instagramming and everything, all of that, when you are an indie person, that is all your brand. That's all exposure. It's all goodwill. And setting expectations, too. Like, I feel like, to some degree, people with really strong online brands, someone like Evil Hat or Ryan Macklin or people like that, like, you feel like you know them, and you don't. Like, Ryan is a different dude than he is online, but he's created a persona that creates certain expectations. You know, like, oh, Ryan worked on this. Okay. Like, I can expect a certain thing from that, because he's consistent. He has this thing. Or Fred Hicks or Rob.
Right.
And I feel like that's what I'm doing, too. I'm not trying to create some kind of artificial thing, but I'm trying to be very present and talk about what I love and what I'm into and share stuff that I think is cool and share my work and make that all part of that picture. And in some ways, it's similar to the art tour thing in film a little bit. Like, you know what you're getting. You go see Lars von Trier, you see Woody Allen movie or whatever, like, it's kind of like that. It's not who they really are. It's not the real person. It's their it's their persona, it's their brand that they've made.
Well, yeah, putting your best foot forward, or the foot that features who you are and what your products are about, is, I think that's great advice for anybody who's trying to make it in any field, especially creative fields, is you do need to be the creator that people want to see more stuff from. So you need to present the type of person that people would want to engage with. And let's face it, we all have to talk to people about our designs, about our podcasts, our blogs, shows, whatever we're doing. So it's very good to be conscious of how you're presenting that, because that's going to determine who wants to engage with your material.
Absolutely. And that's just the world we live in too. I think that's true if you're a pediatrician, honestly, now. Like, everyone has an online brand, an online persona that can be Googled and judged and evaluated. And if you aren't paying attention to that, if you're not, and it, it, again, I hesitate to talk about like creating something here. It's more about participation. Like the more you can participate, the better. One of the story games backlashes, it happens periodically where there's some kind of like weird dust up on story games. And one of them was about, this was, I don't know, 2009 maybe, so kind of right after the first indie boom at Gen Con. Someone made an angry post about, like, well, why does Jason Morningstar's stuff get more attention, and why does Clinton's stuff get more attention, and why do people care when so-and-so posts? You're just elitists, and you're all just patting each other on the back and helping each other out and ignoring everyone else. And they didn't know that, like, we're all... We know each other. We all hang out and talk to each other and do stuff. And part of that is this online thing, but part of it is just that we're friends. And the reason we're friends is because we shared our interests and met at Gen Con and did all this stuff. And every sort of new generation of designer goes through that process, I think. And the ones that don't kind of get cut out, you know, socializing.
Mentioning all of that and talking about the way the game design community is set up, role-playing and role-playing design, it is all part of a community. And the people who are getting attention, people whose designs are taking off, like, sure, sometimes that can be based on the sheer quality of design, but it's also how you're acting in the community. And you need to engage with the community in a harmonic way. Otherwise, you know, why would anybody want to interact with you?
it's not completely one-to-one. But like I said before, when you decide to go your own way and do everything yourself, you have to take on all those jobs. And one of the jobs is marketing. And we live in an era where marketing, a huge part of marketing that corporations struggle to understand and we are very good at, is the social side of things.
Absolutely.
We are experts at social marketing because we didn't know that's what it was. We just used Twitter. And the corporate angle, you know, so many of my corporate clients are like, how can our social media be viral? And, you know, they don't understand what they're doing. But it is a job, and you can choose to engage with it or not. And some people get a little luckier. Like, I don't know how Kevin would feel about me saying this necessarily, but Kevin Crawford, the guy who does Stars Without Number, like, he's a solo operation. He does all his own layouts, which are really well executed, and sources his art and hires artists and writes his games and publishes them and promotes stuff on his website. But he doesn't participate on Story Games or Google Plus or any of that stuff hardly at all. And so he's the exception that proves the rule, right? Like, he doesn't have a big social presence, but other people promote him because his work is so wonderful, and they want to, you know, they want other people to find out about it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And exactly. Like, that is an exception that proves the rule. And you can absolutely do that as a designer. It's just something that I feel a lot of designers should be aware of, especially when they take hostile positions on message boards that I like to participate and have happy fun, is that you're making it harder for yourself. And you don't need to. Nobody needs to. And I feel like You can do that, especially if you don't like interacting with people, but be aware that that's an avenue that you could be shutting down for yourself. And I hate to see any designer do that, because I love games, and the way you get innovation is mixing different minds together. So continuing No, go ahead, please.
One last thought. The best thing a young designer could do is... Who wants to be involved, who's excited about the community. They see these games, they want to make these games, they want to play these games. Play other people's work, and because you're excited about something, that makes other people excited about something. Play at least 100 different role-playing games.
That's really good. And I think the other two things that I wanted to bring up, first is something, because you are not only a good game designer, you're a great visual designer. One of the reasons that I think Lasers and Feelings is so popular is it's just so goddamn nice to look at. And that can be said for Ghost Echo, Lady Blackbird, Mustang. All of these games look so good. And I think that's obviously a skill that you have to train up and takes years to be good at. But there are some guidelines that I think people who are not as talented at that, haven't worked as much at that, could benefit from. How small should font be in your that is something that I think people need to hear.
Well, that's a really contextual thing, but you know, if you're doing print, and it depends on the typeface, honestly. There's a thing in typography called X height, which has to do with the height of a character in the typeface, and some very beautiful typefaces have very small X heights and they look smaller than they are. So Garamond at 9 point looks smaller than Avant-Garde at 9 point, because mm-hmm. Avant-Garde has these big counters and just looks bigger. So it's hard to put a number to it. My advice in general about, you know, how big should my margins be? How big should my type be? How much leading should I use? What should my justification settings be? All those kind of nitty gritty design layout typography questions is to read a book called Elements of Typographic Style by Robert Bringhurst. All the answers to all those questions are in that book. It's wonderful. And that will lead you to 5 or 6 other books that float around that one that are amazing. Jan Schiphold, I think is how you say his name, has a wonderful book about typography as well. But the when it comes to graphic design, there's sort of two elements, and one is somewhat easy and fun to learn. One is just sort of aesthetics and artistry, which is extremely hard to transmit as an instructor. But the other side is craftsmanship, and craftsmanship, you can learn craftsmanship by just brute force. You can just practice and follow the rules and you'll get better, which is awesome. Designing a good page is like building a bookshelf. You measure, you cut, you put your dovetailed sections in and everything fits and it looks beautiful because you copied the master plan for that thing. Then you can totally do that when it comes to laying out your book and doing your typography, making your headers look good and making your type look good. It can seem really arcane and dark and intimidating, but Bringhurst's book is actually fairly technical and can be a little bit intimidating, but when you go to the bookstore to get that one, there'll be 5 or 6 other books in there that are less scary that you can start with. But really it comes down to the craftsmanship part of it is find a book that you love or a layout. Like if you love Lasers and Feelings, just take out a ruler, measure it. If you have a pica ruler, you can measure the point ruler. You can measure the point size of the type with your ruler. You can measure the margins. You can measure the size of the headers. You can measure the leading, and just copy it. Just take that and copy it. There's no, there's this thing about copying, you know, as an artist, like, oh, I don't want to just copy his work. I don't want to trace over his thing or whatever. One of my favorite novelists, Stephen Bruce, has a novel about a painter, and the painter's friends in art school say, oh, when I'm working, I don't like to look at Monet or Van Gogh because I'm afraid they'll influence me. And he's like, what, are you kidding me? I hope they do. I can look at Monet and the amazing. I hope that happens. But there's such an aversion to copying. But when it comes to the craftsmanship of graphic design, copying is your friend. The way text lays on a page, its size and spacing, we've been copying that since 1500 or earlier. And there's just like web design, actually, rules and experiences that form those things. So yeah, copy your favorites shamelessly. Just completely
wonderful.
Copy them. There's no shame in that whatsoever.
That is such great advice.
The aesthetic side is you're on your own.
Right.
I can't help you with aesthetics during this talk. That's a much bigger conversation.
But, yeah. I think
craftsmanship, just practice, copy and practice.
That's totally fair. And for those who are interested, what program do you use or programs do you use to generate your pages and images?
For layout and then Photoshop and Illustrator for graphics. Sometimes it's all in InDesign. My newest Patreon release, I did all the illustrations in InDesign as well, just because I was in the mood to do that. It's a little not best practice necessarily to go that route, but yeah, it's all Adobe stuff. I have always wanted to experiment with the GIMP and Inkscape and whatever it's called, the like open source stuff.
Right.
Clinton Dreisbach, I guess is his name now. He's always done used open source for everything and is kind of a guru in that world. He's a Ruby coder. So Clinton would be a good person to potentially chat up if you want to stick in the free software world. And on story games as well, there's a lot of people that are really into free software. So you don't have to buy like crazy expensive stuff to do your work, but that's what I use. It's my career. So, I mean, that's the tools of the industry. I basically have to have them to do my job.
Well, there are tons
of
hobbyists.
That's true. That's true of a lot of game designers. A lot of us have careers that just happen to line up with making games. Luke Crane used to work in the print industry making books, and you know, it's very nice if you just conveniently happen to have access to this stuff that
right.
you don't have to pay for out of the gate. So, yeah.
Well, with that said, and you making so many hobbyists very happy knowing that they don't have to go out and spend $500 just to engage with this hobby, thank you so much for joining us on the show and lending your wisdom to some of the younger designers out there. And also thank you for so many of the great games that you've made, because they have provided endless enjoyment for both me and my fans. It was great talking to you.
Well, that makes me feel really good. That's wonderful to hear. That's what they're there for. So I really appreciate you saying that. It's been great talking to you too. I had a great time.
Well, heroes, that's it for this week on Critical Success. You can find John Harper's games at 17design.com, and you can support him on Patreon. Critical Success will return in 2 weeks, but you've got the One Shot podcast on Monday and the Campaign podcast on Wednesday to hold you over until then. Guys, if you like these shows, please follow us on Twitter at OneShotRPG, join our community page on Google+, or you can leave us a rating and review on iTunes. The more 5-star reviews we get, the more easily new people can find the show. One Shot is a joint production between Tenpenny Press and Peaches and Hot Sauce. Peaches and Hot Sauce is a Chicago-based comedy network with tons of great articles, videos, and podcasts for you to enjoy at peachesandhotsauce.com. Finally, that music which is right now swelling up over my voice is Be Your Own Pet with Adventure, courtesy of Infinity Cat Records. See you next time, heroes!